Well, we have a good number present for a Sunday evening. That's a good sign. Starting to get some of our people back, and that's good as well. In tonight's lesson, and a subsequent one I intend to do in a couple of weeks here, well, a few weeks, they are both very much about the same subject, but they divide really well. So I didn't feel the need to do them back to back. But the first one is going to be, obviously, if you picked up an outline or noticed the title of the lesson, is going to be The Tide of Premillennialism. And the second one is going to be the tenets of different basic doctrines within premillennialism. As we take a look at this, as we talk about this subject, I suppose that through a number of movies and books and just conversations, etc., that people have, that the doctrine of premillennialism has been brought into the view of what we might consider mainstream America. It doesn't exist any longer, and when I say mainstream, I mean once, if you went back, in excess of 100 years maybe, or, even 100 years, you would find people who believed in the doctrine, but it wouldn't be the majority of people, and it wouldn't be a lot of people. So that there could be plenty of people, if you stood and said, tonight we're going to talk about premillennialism, they have no clue what you're talking about. And even if you began to talk about the rapture and things like that, they'd still have no clue what you were talking about. But that's not the case anymore. If I start saying things like the Left Behind series, or the rapture, or the tribulation, or the events of Revelation, immediately, these things probably, with most of us, if not all of us, these things spring to mind. So what you realize is that there has been, you know, a rising tide, a sweeping tide. And that's where I'm getting the idea for the title of the lesson, of this doctrine of premillennialism. So I want to look at it. I want to talk about what it is, where it came from. Not so much. I'm not going to dig deep into the history like we did with some of the cults. But tonight we'll do a brief overview of the history of it. And then we'll do a brief introduction of it doctrinally. And I'm going to examine a couple of passages in particular, and then we'll leave it at that, and we'll come back, as I say, in a few weeks, and we'll start looking at some of these individual doctrines, and I won't say everything there is to say about them, because we literally could get in a study the rest of the Sunday nights of the year, and you might think I'm exaggerating with that, but I'm not. It does, as you notice what I say on the outline, it does, in fact, permeate the teachings of the Bible throughout. And so you would literally be talking about all the Bible and many significant portions of it. But having said all of that, let's come back and just focus on this idea. Premillennialism, what is it? The word itself signifies, it is a Latin term, millennium. Is a compound Latin term. Technically, I think, mille is an old Latin term for 1,000, and ennium is a new Latin term, to be technical about it, but it basically means 1,000 years. The only time in the Bible discusses 1,000 years is the passage Bill read for us in Revelation 20. But you would think, because of the talk, the excitement over, etc., that this would be a predominant, prevailing idea of the reign of the Messiah for 1,000 years. Premillennialism is the belief that Jesus will, and you should understand this, Jesus will physically return to the earth. He will be on this earth for a second time, and he will literally reign for 1,000 years. Exactly 1,000 years. And if you believe that, then you believe that that has not happened yet, obviously. So we are living in the time before that millennium of 1,000 years, hence pre-millennialism. And that's all it simply means. You believe in a future 1,000 literal year reign of Jesus, and you believe in the time that we are living in the time before that occurs, pre-millennialism. It's largely based, if you look at the Bible, it's largely based on, again, a literal interpretation of a lot of the books of the Bible, especially if you're open in your Bible to Revelation still. It would be a literal interpretation of Revelation. You might say, well, don't we literally interpret the Bible? We do in many passages. But some passages demand, and we'll look at this, they demand that we interpret them not literally, but figuratively, or more specifically, significantly, although that's not the way we use the English term, and I'll explain more about that. But it's based on a literal interpretation of the books, especially of Revelation in the New Testament, and especially of the prophets in the Old Testament. Daniel would come to mind first, but not only Daniel, many significant portions of Ezekiel and Isaiah and the so-called minor prophets and the Psalms, and on we could go. You would even have portions of Job, and as I say, a lot of the Bible would factor into that. And if you believe in that literal interpretation, then you believe the fulfillment of those prophecies, etc., occur mostly in this future millennium, and so, or just shortly before it. We'll explain more about that. Just shortly before or during the millennium. And so obviously you don't believe that the prophecies have anything to do with the church age, and the church as it is takes on a whole different significance. Literally, if you're looking at the doctrine of premillennialism, you begin to see the church not as, and I want you to hear this carefully, the church is not the culmination of God's plan. It was not God's one great plan to have the church of Christ and to have Jesus as its head and so forth, but rather was merely an afterthought of God, where God literally could not affect his plan as he wanted to and meant to during the first century, because the Jews messed it up. He could not affect his plan, and so basically God said, I've got to come up with a plan B, and so I'll go with the church idea. And so the church becomes really, according to this view, an insignificant, and you should understand that, an insignificant afterthought. Where Judaism, the whole Jewish system, is the most important system, and that all we are doing right now is we are in a brief interlude, however long it lasts, an afterthought period, waiting on the restoration of Judaism. Now you can see, if you believe that, how it would affect your interpretation of the Bible. Not just a passage here and there, but how it would affect major portions of, for example, the Old Testament, even as well as the New, not just the book of Revelation. You should also understand, if you're looking at this doctrine, as we're just kind of defining or describing it as a whole doctrine, that the majority of premillennialists, not all of them, but the majority, are also what are called, if you're looking on your outline, point number two and down in letter C, they are also pre-tribulationist. Now again, the majority, it doesn't mean all of them are, but the majority are pre-tribulationists, which means, in simple terms, they believe that Jesus' reign will begin, his reign of 1,000 years or a millennium, will begin at the end of a period of intense tribulation called the Great Tribulation, in which numerous natural and man-made calamities will occur. And they believe this tribulation is it follows the rapture. We'll talk a little bit about that, and we'll talk more about that in the next lesson. But they believe that this period of tribulation, usually believed to be 7 years, will follow the rapture and will take place here on the earth, but again, understand, all is in the future. So they're pre-tribulation. They're pre-tribulation of 7 years, followed by 1,000 years of the reign of Jesus. So that whole gamut there, that whole period of time, is roughly 1,007 years, and then whatever amount of time during the lifetime of the Antichrist that we will talk about, whatever amount of time, the lifetime of the Antichrist that leads up to that event, the 7 years of tribulation, and then the 1,000 years is that whole period, really, that falls under the doctrine. And some believe we are in the preliminary stages of it. Others would say we don't know. Many of these people believe that surely all of these events would really kick in around the year 2000 because they are millennialists and they figured significant events would take place every 1,000 years. And so, if those of you that are a little older, you may remember all the scare tactics that surrounded the year 2000, which kind of came and went, you know, with sort of a whimper, but they're afraid. The tribulation, of course, of 7 years is supposed to follow the rapture, and we all know, I'm sure we've seen the movies, et cetera, et cetera. The rapture is supposed to be literally, there's a group of us in here tonight. And if you're faithful to Christ at the time of the rapture, up into the air you go, and the rest of us are left behind to suffer the consequences of not being faithful. And we'll talk more about that. Historically, if you're looking down at the outline, historically, premillennialism is not a modern doctrine. It may seem like it is, but it's not. And when I say that, I understand. I went back and read this afternoon. Went back and read a 200-year-old commentary, in fact, a little over 200 years now, just to see the idea, the attitude about it. Now, it existed during that day, but it was considered radical, strange. And a well-known commentator was making the point about how some people get all carried away into these strange doctrines, basically a premillennial, even though it wasn't called that, these strange doctrines of the end times, he said. And he went off into talking about that. So you should understand that it's not a modern doctrine. It's in fact been taught throughout the Christian era. I went back and I was reading the other night some comments that were made by a commentator not 200 years ago, but more on the order of 1700 years ago, one of the so-called church fathers who believed in it. And, you know, he was talking about it just about like some people today would talk about it. He believed in those literal explanations of certain passages. So it's an ancient doctrine. And in some respects, it even predates Christianity. Now you might say, how could it predate Christianity? Well, the Jews, some of them were premillennialist in their day before Christ, but they believed in a lot of very similar things. They believed the Messiah. And you can see this in the New Testament. They believed the Messiah was coming, and he was coming to earth, and he was coming to earth to set up an earthly kingdom to rule on the throne in Jerusalem. And really, Jesus was a disappointment to all of that view. We even see the apostles. I think it's evident in Acts chapter 1, will you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? And that kind of question, you can see a lot of these kinds of beliefs, even within them, and a total misunderstanding of Jesus and what his kingdom was to be about. They shouldn't have misunderstood it. And Jesus, when he teaches them about the kingdom, has to begin, if you remember in Luke 24, from the beginning and take every single prophet and explain to them what he's about and the kingdom is about, etc. And that really shows you how immersed in their own version of premillennialism, the Jews were. So it's an ancient doctrine. A lot of the beliefs are ancient. But the term itself, premillennialism, the term itself is a modern term. It finally was a term that was coined in the mid-1800s and attached to this whole system of beliefs about the time the view began to grow into popularity. And I want you to think back with me, if you will, when we were studying the Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you remember, we talked about the roots. If you remember those, all those charts and all those studies, the roots of the movement. And the roots of the movement had its beginning, obviously, in all of those people, those Bible study groups who were coming together from different denominations, remember, and they were studying eschatology, or end times, our last things. And some of these people that emerge from that, that went on to establish what we know as the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Seventh-day Adventists, or people like that, those very people and those evangelistic efforts, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on all those doors and so forth, I believe, and this is a personal opinion, take it with a grain of salt, but I think that really is as much as anything responsible for so many people in so many denominations buying into the view. Now, it's helped by other things. I mean, if you went back even before the mid-1800s with all of that, you could go back to the very late 1700s. And you could see, oddly enough, and you might find this strange, you could see premillennialism for the first time within a denomination as a whole beginning to grow. And oddly enough, it's not among the Baptists, who so many of them believe it today. It was among the Anglicans. Those we know today as either the Anglican Church, some of you, or many of you, the Episcopal Church. And I find that strange to a degree, but not so much. Again, if you go back to some of the ancient Catholic writers, it would not appear so strange if you read them. But nonetheless, you had the Anglican Church in the late 1700s, and then in the mid-1800s, you have all of these cultic-type movements teaching this doctrine and people being fascinated, just enamored with it. Remember how many people are drawn to those prophecies, you know, in the early part of the Jehovah's Witnesses and so forth, drawn to those prophecies that the world is going to end at such and such a time. And then you have those major events of the 20th century that seem to usher it in, like World War I and World War II and some of those events surrounding that. So it became a growing, just a growing doctrine. And it was helped along, finally, and many denominational people bought into it. And if I were to ask you what historical event stands out, some of you would probably suggest 1948. And if you're familiar with your history, you realize that following World War II and all the settling out, so to speak, that followed World War II, in 1948, Israel was reestablished as a nation. And to many people here in America, that was the beginning. I mean, that they had heard it, they had listened to it, they had bought into it in many respects, and it just frightened people. It was as though God was making it happen. Israel, a nation again, are you kidding? I mean, it's not possible. Right in the middle of a Muslim stronghold, Israel is now a nation. And a lot of Americans bought into it, and if you realize it, a lot of Americans have still bought into it. And so you will find even a common man on the street that really isn't all that religious, does maybe never goes to church or whatever, and for religious reasons, he believes that America ought to hold favor, or it ought to favor Israel, and policies ought to be, you know, conducted favorably toward Israel. Now, as a side note, I think it's great for us to have Israel as an ally, at least to have a position in the Middle East, but it's got nothing to do with what I believe the Bible teaches about Israel. We'll talk more about that in the next lesson, the restoration of Israel. But just understand that, as much as anything in 1948, helped to foster this growing acceptance by so many people. Even in the Lord's church, if you go back and now it's past the lifetime of many members of the church, but I can remember when I first became a member of the church in the 70s, you had older people. I could go to older people and ask them, and yeah, they remembered it. If you went back to the 20s, even the teens, but especially in the 1930s, premillennialism was a sweeping tide through the Church of Christ. And a lot of churches and a lot of members were threatened by it. And so the work of men such as Foy E. Wallace, now that may or may not be a familiar name to you, go back 50 years and every member of the church knew the guy. But men such as that who fought it and debated it hotly, hardly, those guys, you know, did a lot of teaching that helped keep the majority of the members of the church out of premillennialism, but you should understand there still is a significant number of premillennial churches of Christ, even in America. And so it's something that has, and what I'm saying in all of that, is that it's a doctrine that in many respects has affected basically every denomination to some degree. Some of them in a major way. Some denominations are almost purely premillennial. Whole schools are dedicated to it. The school I went to, for example, that is a major Baptist college of now over 50,000 people, and they all believe it. I mean, almost to a person. Many times I would be in a class, or in the cafeteria or whatever, and there wasn't a single person that didn't believe it. And so you see how just whole huge groups are given to it. Now, I can go on and on and on about the history, but I think that's enough. I just want us to understand somewhat of a basic historical overview. Now, far more importantly is the Bible and doing a doctrinal overview, because undoubtedly, even right now, if we went around this room, you've got family members or friends who believe, or whatever. They question, at least, things such as the rapture and the book of Revelation, and on it goes. So I want to take a look at that. If you hold the doctrine, like I said, it permeates all through Scripture, and a great portion of Scripture is swept along with it. And it distorts your interpretation of a lot of passages. I mean, major portions of the prophets, all practically of Revelation, at least chapter 6 through 19 or 19 and 20 or whatever, the Psalms, and on it goes. So it's not just maybe one obscure passage somewhere. You can see that it's something that affects a major portion of the Bible. Now let me illustrate, and just for illustration purposes only, go with me to Matthew 24. Let me illustrate the difference of how a premillennialist approaches, say, a passage like Matthew 24, as opposed to what I would assume most, if not everybody in here, how they would approach it. Now, if you're looking at Matthew 24, let's first of all set the basic context, because I don't want anyone to misunderstand that all the stuff I'm going to say about premillennialism, that I believe it. I don't. The basic context is this. Jesus is on that last public day in the temple. And when I say last public day, I mean after this, he will basically be private, and then there will be the crucifixion, etc. So this is the last public day before that really he spends on earth. All right, before on that day, he's rebuking the Pharisees with the harshest rebuke, whatever, that he ever gives. And we recognize that. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Can't talk tonight. But woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. Now you'll remember in this context, going back to chapter 23 and verse 36, that Jesus was specifically rebuking that generation. And that was without question. He will say, for example, in verse 36, after rebuking them so harshly, he will say, verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. Then if you'll notice, if you'll follow with me, in verse 37, he will weep over Jerusalem. We see that in Luke. But he'll bemoan Jerusalem and say, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. And you need to keep in mind that when he says that, this idea of you that kill the prophets and so forth, and he had chastised the Pharisees, which of the prophets did you not kill? That follows, if you go back to Matthew 21, and I'm not going to do that, but you can. If you go back to Matthew 21, that follows Jesus in the temple saying to those same people, prophets were sent to you one after the other, and finally even the Son of Man, the God's own Son, will be sent to you. But you took those prophets and you killed them, and you're going to kill the Son of God. And for doing that, the kingdom is going to be taken away from you and given to somebody else. Now you have to understand that what he says here follows that. That this is just a conclusion to all of that. So, I mean, if you went back in Matthew and you started in Matthew chapter 21 and followed along, you see parable after parable about the kingdom. You see Jesus rebuking them and saying such straightforward things to them. In other words, what he's saying is this is the end. God has had enough, and this is the end for you as a nation, as a kingdom. It's going to be taken from you and given to somebody else. So now he bemoans, notice, the city of Jerusalem, which, if you think about it, being the Son of God, is his city. And so as he bemoans them, he says, verse 38, your house, by decree of God, is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, you will not see me henceforth till you shall say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. Again, this is his last public time with them. Now, I don't want to get too deep into that, but I think we see the point. Now, in chapter 24, he goes outside the temple, if you notice, departs from the temple, his disciples follow him, and they go to, apparently, the high, you know, higher up on the hill there, and they look off out over the temple, and you can do that. You can see a map of Jerusalem and easily see how they would do that. They would just walk outside the temple, go outside the gates, go up the mountain or up the hill, whatever you want to call it, and you could sit down on the side of it and just kind of look over the whole temple there. So Jesus does that, and the disciples begin, if you'll notice in verse 1, to show him the buildings of the temple. Why would they do that? Well, they're impressive. Remember when Jesus in John 2 had driven the money changers out, and they had said, you know, and he said, destroy this temple, 3 days I'll build it up. And they said, 46 years the temple's been in building. Well, actually, if you go back historically, Herod had gotten monetary approval from Rome to beautify the temple, to occupy the minds of the Jews and keep them satisfied, to keep trouble down. And that followed some rebellions and so forth, and it pacified them. And they had been working, literally by the time that the disciples showed Jesus the temple, that temple has been restored. It's been a restoration project for just about 50 years. I imagine it was unbelievably gorgeous. Impressive. And they looked out over the temple and they showed him all of that. And this is how Jesus answered it in verse 2. Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left one stone, left here, one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now why do I stress all that? Because if you're a premillennialist, you ignore every bit of that. Okay? When I was in school and we would go to Matthew 24 over and over and over again, we ignored every bit of that. And you can imagine, they're always seeing my hand go up. But, excuse me, you know, what about all of these? Well, not significant. What was significant was verse 3. So when you would start in premillennialism to look at Matthew 24, you start at verse 3. Now notice verse 3. Jesus has just said, temple going to be so destroyed, not one stone left on another. As he sat on the Mount of Olives. Well, what does that mean? A few minutes go by, they're thinking about it, you know, maybe they're questioning among themselves. Man, what does he mean? Temple's going to be torn down? We don't know. But as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately. So I take it they went away and came back at some point. Some little time passes. And they say, tell us, notice the questions. Tell us, when shall these things be? Now, what is that? Well, these things would be verse 2, not one stone left on another, etc. The kingdom taken away from you, etc., etc. Tell us, when shall these things be? And maybe in their discussion, they talked about the fact that if all of that is so, in their minds, if the temple could be destroyed like that, was it the very end of time? We don't know. We don't know how they were thinking. But they said, tell us when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? Now that's what they asked. And that's what Jesus answers. If you look at the answer Jesus gives, he will answer their question, and he will answer it, and I want you to hear this carefully, he will answer it by telling them specifically what the signs are that the destruction of the temple is coming. And he will finally add at the end of that discussion some more points about the sign of his great coming and the sign of the end of the world. And he takes their questions in order and he answers them in order. Now, if you're a premillennialist, you don't hear that. You hear them saying, "What shall the end of the world be?" in verse 3. These things doesn't refer to what Jesus is talking about. These things refer to the end of the world. And you hear Jesus saying, "The sign of my second coming and the sign of the end of the world will be these." And so he begins to talk. Now, if you follow Matthew 24, you see Jesus saying things like, and that's why you hear people quoting this. You see people talking about false Christ and wars and rumors of wars. I'm sure you've heard that phrase. And you hear people talking about the gospel has to be preached in all the world. Look down at verse 14. The gospel of the kingdom's got to be preached in all the world. And when all of that happens, notice verse 14, then shall the end come. If you grew up in the 70s, you saw televangelist after premillennial televangelist point out to you that the gospel for the first, we want to carry the gospel into whatever African nation, whatever South American nation. We want to get the gospel into whatever deep recesses of Asia, because we know, they were excited about it. We know that once the gospel reaches every little corner of the world, Jesus is coming back, and they wanted him to come back. Well, that's not what Jesus is saying. Again, you have to remember the context, and the context begins by Jesus saying, what I'm talking about is what's happening to this generation. You people today. You living people. And then Jesus says, I tell you, not one stone of the temple is going to be left on another. And the disciples say, tell us when. Jesus says, fine, I'll tell you when. When you see earthquakes and famines and the gospel preached in all the world, then the end will come. And you will see, verse 15, just like Daniel, when Antiochus the Fourth or Antiochus Epiphanes went in and defiled the temple. And if you understand that history, that's what, when they had the Maccabean revolt and they lit the candle, that's where Hanukkah comes from and all of that. You're going to see a very similar situation with a foreign king go into the temple and defile it. And literally, this one is not just going to defile the temple and burn a pig and sacrifice. He's going to tear it down stone by stone. And that happened. The Romans went in and defiled it. And then literally ripped it apart because they had mortared the thing with a mixture of gold. So they tore it apart stone by stone, melted it down, and got the gold out. That's what Jesus is talking about. But if you're a premillennialist, you read this passage and you say, all right, these are the signs of the end. Now, if you'll notice, if you continue reading here, that he talks about all of that. And he talks about people running scared and all of that kind of thing. They are fleeing Jerusalem and all of that's going on. And if you look down in verse 21, they see, jump off the page, then shall be great tribulation. To a premillennialist, that's the 7 years of tribulation. So what do they see in Matthew 24? Well, here's exactly what they see. They see Matthew 24 and all of these prophecies that have never been fulfilled, they say. Although you can look at every single one of them, including the gospel preached in all the world in Colossians chapter 1, as having been fulfilled by the AD 60s. But they see them as not having been fulfilled. And so what they say is, as it nears the point where Jesus will return, all of these signs come about. And many, if not most of them, are effected through the leadership, and we'll talk more about it, the leadership of the Antichrist. He will bring it about. And Jesus, to spare the faithful, will come back, not to earth yet, but come back to the air, and all the faithful will be raptured up in the air somewhere to be with Jesus, while 7 years of great tribulation, Matthew 24, verse 21, takes place on the earth. Now you notice the way it reads. Then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be. And that's scary to people. And then it goes on to describe it and describe what goes on during the Great Tribulation as far as they see. And then, if you'll notice, it begins to say, immediately verse 29, after the tribulation of those days, will the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars will fail from heaven, the powers of heaven will be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Notice this. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He'll send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet and gather all the elect together, etc., etc. Now, what is all of that? As we will talk more specifically about it and show the passages where this comes from. After 7 years are over, all those saints, all those Christians waiting up in the air, all this mess goes on down here. And all of this mess is all of those literal interpretation of Revelation. While all of this goes on, at the end of 7 years, it culminates in a great war. And we're going to talk about that. And as it culminates in a great war, the Battle of Armageddon, obviously, it would literally wipe out so many people, so many millions and millions and millions die. It would literally wipe out every human being from the earth if Jesus didn't stop. So Jesus comes swooping down out of heaven, Revelation 19, on a great white horse. He comes swooping down out of heaven and just stops it cold. And when he stops it cold, the battle ends. All the enemies are subdued. Revelation 19, about verses 20 and 21 there you can see. He cast all the enemies into the abyss. Then finally, Revelation 20, he throws Satan into the abyss. And a world without Satan now is subdued by King Jesus. He goes on the throne, and Revelation 20 talks about it. As he ascends to the throne, there he rules. Matthew 24 is showing you that. There he rules as the king with a rod of iron. And he rules for 1,000 years. During which time, people are given the opportunity to convert, not to Christianity, but to a restored Judaism with Jesus as the king. They can proselytize to restore Judaism and be saved. At the end of that 1,000 years, that's it. And Jesus will then judge everybody. Some will go to hell, some will go to heaven, and the world will end. Now that's the premillennial view. And if you look at that, you realize how many ideas about the rapture and the Antichrist and the reign of Jesus and the position of Christians and what Judaism is all about and its intention by God and the church and what it's all about and what God intended for it. All of those ideas. And how much of the Bible discusses all of that? But all of that is involved in premillennialism. So what we have then is we have a doctrine that incorporates the massive part of the Bible into its view. We obviously are not going to go through every single passage in every single book. Now you can begin to understand why I say we study every Sunday night all year and still not touch it. But we'll look at it. We'll look at the major doctrines. And I'll try to make it as simple as possible and as straightforward as possible. And I'll say, this is a major doctrine, and here's the major passage or two where it starts. And then, of course, they will see it in many others. But that's enough for tonight, so let's close with that. If you're here tonight and not a Christian, as you begin to get into some of these ideas and so forth, you realize that a lot of these doctrines are problems that stem from people, sometimes unknowingly, who approach the Bible without proper study. Those are maybe the more honest ones. And from a dishonest point of view, they approach it from the standpoint of what will thrill and sensationalize, impress people. You may remember I've told you often, and so I'll tell you again, that when I was in school, one of the comments that was made to me in one of my theology classes, we were discussing Daniel, and I was telling what I'm sure the simple view you would tell of the passage, and how one of the seminary students looked at me and said, if I believe what you believe, it'd be boring. And I, you know, my answer to that was, if you believe the truth, it's not boring. The truth is never boring. But sadly, that's the way people see it. This idea of a massive worldwide and literally worldwide war and an evil Antichrist. Remember the Omen movies, some of you that are older. All of these things are so fascinating. But you know, if you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you may be looking at all of that and saying, but wait a minute. What does the Bible really teach? The Bible really teaches a very simple message. And that is that Jesus has come, and He has died, and that He is going to come again. All of that's true. And when He comes again, we are going to meet Him in judgment, and then we are either going to be in heaven or we're going to be in hell. And it's a very simple view. To escape hell, you can be part of the Lord's church. It wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't plan B. It was God's great intention to marry a group of people to the Son of God. And that's a great position. To me, that's as fascinating and sensational as anything can be. You can be part of that. Confess your belief in Jesus and be willing to live your life for Him. Be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. And if you've done that and your life is not what it needs to be, correct what's wrong. And ask for forgiveness, ask for the prayers of the people here. And I know the people will be glad to pray together with you. Won't you please come while James leads us in the song.